G'day everyone, welcome to another Toon Under podcast, the Southern Hemisphere's biggest and best podcast for all things Newcastle United. Tonight we're here to talk about the FA Cup quarterfinals against Manchester City, the Anton Sibieski Cup, as I like to refer it to, the fourth installment this season, unfortunately for us. So, it's a 4:30 a.m. kickoff. Live on Paramount Plus here in Australia. I'm sure to be on ITV or somewhere like that in the UK. Tonight we've got a very special guest. He was pretty much the voice of my late teenage years and his early adult childhood or adult life. He's born in Manchester, a lifelong Manchester City supporter. He's a drummer of a heavy metal band. And in his part time, he's covered World Cups and Asian Cups, Olympics, all the Socceroos and Matildas. You can hear him on the A-League coverage. You can see him on there as well sometimes. You can also hear him on SEN, Alex Bross, The Global Game. It's an absolute honour for Simon Hill to join us tonight. Simon, how are you?
How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me on your show.
It's great to have you on. So with all our guests, I think the way I like to go is the best place to start is the start. So Manchester City, how did you fall into that? Were you bought or forced into it?
Yeah, well, a bit of both. Obviously, you know, I'm from Manchester, so it was one of the two. And all my family are City fans. My dad, in particular, he's still around. He's nearly 90. Was a season ticket holder for many, many years. He's not anymore because he struggles to go to the ground now. He can't walk very well. But still watches all the games on TV. My granddad was a lifelong City fan before he died. And my great-granddad, a guy called Fred Taylor, actually played for City in the 1890s. Even before they were Manchester City, they were known as Hardwick FC. So it's one of those family heirlooms that is passed down from generation to generation. And yeah, so apart from the geography, I didn't really have much choice. I was handed my team at, you know, 3 or 4 years of age, enrolled as a junior blue by the time I was five, and that was it.
Yeah, so you mentioned your dad's been a season ticket holder for a long time and stuff like that. What's your earliest memories of supporting the club?
Well, I went to my first game in April 1974, which makes me feel very old, probably before you were born. I don't remember too much about that game, although later I learned it was against Ipswich Town and we lost 3-1. But I do remember quite vividly the second game, which was at the start of the 74-75 season, which was against West Ham United at the Old Main Road. And I was that little bit older then. I think I was nearly seven. And my dad took me along, said, "Do you want to go?" And I was keen. And he bought me this sky blue and maroon. I know you say maroon in Australia, but we call it maroon. rosettes with the City colours. And that was really the start of it. I don't know why that rosette resonated with me so much. But, you know, it was almost that sense of belonging. And when I saw the players come out with the sky blue jerseys, I instantly fell in love, I think, with the colour. As much as anything else.
You didn't
know too much about football in those days because I was a kid. But yeah, that was the start of it. And from then on, really up until me being an adult and going away to university, I was there every other week at the home games. And by the time I got to my teenage years, I was, you know, a member of the travel club, the supporters club. I was going on the old football specials on the trains, which for some people was a bit hairy.
Yeah. It would have been back then.
Water club coaches. So, you know, I was an absolute fanatic and still am to a large degree. Obviously, you know, it's a bit more difficult living so far away now, but, you know,
yeah.
My club and always will be.
So how do you go with the time difference and stuff like that? You're obviously a very busy man. Do you try and get up and watch as many games as you can, or given with our Optus sort of feed that we've got, we can get up and watch them in our own time? But you kind of,
Yeah, look, I don't like watching games after they've happened.
Yeah,
go on Twitter or whatever it is, the BBC website, and find out what the score is too overwhelming for me. So I like to watch them live when I can. Obviously, that's not always possible. You know, you've got work commitments or you're literally too tired. And as you can tell by the grey hair, I'm getting on it. So, but I do watch, you know, I would say 80 to 90% of the City games. And yeah, you know, I'm still as passionate as ever. I'm watching the Liverpool game the other night at, what was it, up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, they're the Wimbledon Sunday night.
My neighbours.
On Monday morning, yeah. we had this like constant conversation in our podcast group of in the middle of the night if something exciting happens and trying to keep your composure to not wake up your kids or your missus in the house and things like that as well. So I totally understand how you, I don't know, try and keep it in, but you want to let it retire.
Yeah, I think age, you know, helps a little bit as well. You can put a little bit more into perspective as you get older.
But, yeah,
you know, when I was younger, I'd sulk for days if we didn't win.
I still sulk for days if we don't win, especially Tuesday morning was the Chelsea game. We had 7 o'clock a year in Melbourne, so we've got all day to stew on it, which is never good. And you try and keep shooting some stuff on Twitter and. Most of the UK is asleep, so you kind of don't have that outlet you can either agree with or disagree with or whatever. You just got to stew on it all day and kind of hope work takes over and you forget about it. But
not sure.
When, you've been a lifelong supporter, do you have a favourite player? I know it's always a hard question. There's so many players that have gone through, but do you have a favourite player?
It's not hard for me. It has and always will be Colin Bell. He was my first footballing idol. Again, he's probably a long time before, you know, you were born, but Colin Bell was the first player that I really idolized. And for younger viewers, he was around in the 1970s. And he was an England international. He was nicknamed Nijinsky, which was the name of a racehorse for his unbelievable stamina. And in those days, of course, there was no social media, there was no Facebook, no Twitter, no YouTube. So, you know, that your heroes in those days were very remote from you. And Colin was almost a recluse in many ways. He didn't like media attention. So that almost added to his mystique, if you like. And I did get to meet him once, which was one of the joys of being a junior Blue, is that they used to hold branch meetings and we were all kids. Every other Sunday. So they would bring a player or two along. And every time I'd go along, I'd be like, is it Colin Bell this week? And it never was until ultimately he showed up. And I think I was so starstruck. I don't think I even had the courage to ask him for an autograph. But yeah, he was my idol. I had big posters of him up on my wall. And obviously there's been many players since, particularly in the modern era, because the modern team is so good. That I love Sergio Aguero, David Silva, Vincent Kompany in particular. You know, I loved going back a bit further, Georgie Kinkladze, even Trevor Francis in the early 1980s, although he only played for us for one season. So there's been a lot of players that I've loved down the years, but Colin Bell is very special, not just to me, but for a lot of City fans. And that's why he's got the stand named after him at the Etihad.
Yeah. So was he playing when you sort of going as a youngster with your dad as that seven-year-old?
Yeah.
Starry-eyed and stuff like that?
Yeah. United had Best, Law and Charlton, which was their, you know, dream trio. And our holy trinity was Summerby, Bell and Lee. Mike Summerby, Franny Lee and Colin Bell. So Colin played, I think, in the very first game that I went to watch. And my formative years watching City, he was a regular. And then unfortunately, he got a very bad injury, which ultimately finished his career, which was in late 1975, playing a League Cup tie against United, of course. And he went into a tackle with Martin Buchan and destroyed his knee. These days, he'd probably be, you know, okay within 12 months, but in those days, the medical standards weren't quite so good. And when he came back and took it, strangely enough, he came back in a game on Boxing Day 1977 against Newcastle.
Oh, really?
And I was there that day, and he'd been out for 18 months, and the reception he got was incredible. He even said it brought tears to his eyes, which was a lot for Colin because he wasn't a very emotional man. But he wasn't quite the same player. His leg looked a little bit stiff, and he played in a different position. He ended up playing as a centre-back because he wasn't very mobile. So he wasn't quite the same after that, and he retired not long after that. But, yeah, that was what. And by the way, we beat you 4-0 like that.
Oh, that was my next question. So, a lifelong fan, and this might be another tough one for you. Do you have a favourite memory? And sometimes that might not mean the treble last year and things like that, but a memory that you hold close to your heart.
Yeah, there's a few, to be honest. You know, winning the league in 2012, the first time we won the championship since 1968, which we did against Newcastle, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
One blind, 4-3. And I was lucky enough to be there to watch that game against QPR. I paid, I think it was £1,000 for a ticket, but I had to be there. So that would certainly be one. 12 months prior to that, we won our first trophy since 1976.
Well, we won the League Cup by beating Newcastle.
When we beat Stoke in the final. But my favourite memory really of that cup run was the semi against Manchester United, which I also went to, because that was the moment that the balance of power in Manchester switched because we beat them. And it was the first time in a major game that we'd beaten them in a long, long time. And I remember thinking, it's changed now. So that was very, very special. I was with mates. My dad was there as well, you know, so that's a big memory. But there's lots of others. The FA Cup final as long ago as 1981, which was my first trip to Wembley, even though we didn't win against Tottenham. And, you know, derby games down the years. We beat United 5-1 at Main Road in 1989. I enjoyed that one very much. And, you know, there's been lots more since. But, I would say that those two, the semi-final against United in 2011 and then winning the league for the first time the year after, mainly because both times I was there.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't want to speak for you, but I think that title win probably could nearly be a lot of people's favourites if they weren't there as well, just the way it all happened and things like that. And I think Martin Tyler said you
was really, but
you'll never see anything like it again. And I don't think you will.
No, but for 95 minutes, that was the worst day of my life.
Oh,
we blowed it. And then obviously in the end, we turned it around. And, you know, I remember a lot of people saying to me after Scott, you must have had a big night that night. I was exhausted. To go through that whole range of emotions and then finally to get over the line. Because I remember sitting in the stands thinking, we are never going to live this down. Not only are we going to lose the title at home against a team that was in danger of being relegated, but United are going to win it instead of us. So it was a nightmare that turned into a dream at the last.
Yeah. So did you have access to the scores and things like that? Did people around you have reception on their phones? I know that seems to be a big problem in stadiums that are full.
Yeah, we knew that United were winning. I don't think by the time Aguero scored, we knew it was full time at the Stadium of Light, but to be honest, obviously, if we won, it didn't matter what United did. It was all we did. So, I think we were aware, but that moment when Aguero's shot hits the back of the net, I'll never forget. I was hugging strangers and all sorts was going on. It was amazing.
Yeah, was there? I might be wrong. Was there a slight delay on that game, and that's why it finished a few minutes later, or was the delay from the whole Joey Barton brain explosion?
Yeah, I think the stoppage time that was added on meant, because of that stoppage for Joey Barton's send-off, I think meant that City's game went on maybe 2 minutes longer than United. So United's game had finished, and if you remember that,
I remember it finished, but I couldn't remember there was a delay.
No, I'm going, what's the final score?
Yeah.
They didn't know, and, you know...
I think they were at Sunderland too, weren't they, for memory?
Yeah, Sunderland.
Yeah.
Beat Sunderland. Wade Rooney scored. But obviously because we won, it didn't matter.
Nice. All right, well, we might sort of move on to your broadcasting career now, because that's been very storied. I don't know this, and look, I'm a big fan of yours and loved your work for a long time. What was the catalyst that you moved to Australia?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a long story, to be honest. So I worked for well over a decade in the UK. I was working for the BBC. And then in 2001, I moved over to ITV, which, as I'm sure you know, is one of the terrestrial channels in the UK. And they started up a new digital, today we call it a streaming service. And it was basically to rival Sky Sports. And they... I knew the bosses at ITV, and that one of them wanted me to go over and join this new network. And they offered me a fair bit of money for those days. And so I decided to transfer over to ITV. And I thought I was going to be there for a long time. Unfortunately, within 12 months, the channel, which was very new, had pretty poor technology, ran into huge financial difficulties. And within 12 months, the channel closed down and we were all made redundant. So I was looking for a job. I was freelancing in the UK at various places. And in the middle of all that was, if you remember, the World Cup in 2002, which was in Japan and Korea. Now, I had plans to go over and watch that as a fan. So I went over with a friend to watch a few games in Korea. And an old friend of mine from the BBC, a guy called Rob Minchell, who I'd worked with at the BBC World Service, had emigrated to Australia some years beforehand. And he said to me, why don't you come over and spend a few days with me at the end of the World Cup? So I said, sure. So I came over to Australia, never been to the country before. And whilst I was over here, Robbie said to me, you know, there's a job going at SBS as a commentator, because the other guy's not well or something. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, you should go for it. And I said, Robbie, they don't know who I am. I live on the other side of the world. But he banged on about it so much that in the end, to be honest, more to keep him quiet than anything else, I said, look, when I go back to the UK, I'll send a letter and a CV and a showreel, thinking that would be the end of it. So I did. And to my utter amazement, I got a reply within a few days from Ken Shipp, who was the deputy head of sport at SBS, still there to this day, and said that, look, we're very interested. We've seen your CV, your showreel. Would you like to come and, you know, work for us in Australia? And to be honest, I was absolutely gobsmacked. And I'd never expected it. So at that time, you know, I didn't have a job in London. I wasn't married, didn't have any kids, still don't have any kids. So I thought, well, why not? You know, I'll go and do something different. It's an opportunity. Go and live in a different country. And so, yeah, that's how it happened. So I came over here in 2003, thinking probably along with, you know, most expats, I'll be there for a year or two and I'll probably go back home, but I'm still here.
Yeah. So did you move to New South Wales when you first came over? Is that where the SBS head offices were?
Yeah. I've always lived in Sydney since I've been in Australia. That's obviously where most of the media is based. So,
yeah.
And certainly where SBS were based. So, yeah.
So we're, yeah, what, nearly coming up, what, 20 years?
It's over 20
years. Oh, it is over 20 years, yeah. What's your favourite moment as a broadcaster since you've moved over?
Most people at this point will expect me to say the Uruguay qualifier in 2005, but it's not that, because I didn't particularly enjoy that that night professionally. It wasn't the easiest, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I've recounted that tale many, many times. I would probably say the World Cup in Germany in 2006. That was very special for a lot of reasons. Special for me personally because although I'd been to World Cups, I hadn't commentated on one before that. And also because, you know, it was a very special World Cup for Australia after 32 years away. And of course, you know, they did well as well. They got to the second round. And we had some great moments along the way, the win over Japan and the draw against Croatia, which was hugely dramatic.
So I was
alone down and
fully endorsed that. And football in those days, you know, was at a real peak of popularity in Australia. So yeah, that was a happy time.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's one of probably my favourite memory as an Australian fan as well. Watched getting up in the middle of the night. But I think the best bit about it was it wasn't just the diehards that were getting up in the middle of the night. It seemed to be nearly the whole country was getting up and sort of getting around it. Like, we could go on for years on a podcast about why things aren't the way they are from back then.
Well, that's probably another podcast that it...
Yeah.
You're right. I mean, I'll give you one very quick story that the day after they qualified against Uruguay, I got a phone call from Football Australia saying, are you able to host like a celebration party at Tumbalong Park in Sydney, which is near Mrs. Macquarie's chair. It's like a big, you know, open field. And they erected a stage and they got all the players down. And I turned up and there must have been 5,000 people there. And I was like, you know, when I first arrived in Australia, they couldn't get 5,000 people to go and watch them in a stadium. And all of a sudden they were heroes wherever they went. And there was one guy who'd got out of his hospital bed. He had a drip attached and with a nurse alongside him to help him. And he said, I wasn't going to miss this. I couldn't go to the stadium last night, so I had to be here today. So yeah, it was massive. It was great.
Yeah, it really cut through. What about a player that you've loved commentating over the years? Do you have someone who you kind of look at your schedule and like, oh, I can't wait to watch this guy play?
Yeah, I'll give you one from each of the two halves of my career, if you like. When I was in the UK, one of my favourite Premier League players to watch live, even though he didn't play for my team, was Dennis Bergkamp. He was extraordinary. And even better when you saw him live, because you could see in back play how he read the game and how he anticipated where the ball was going to be. And he always seemed to me to be two moves ahead. So he was sensational. You know, Thierry Henry as well in the same team, that the two of them were very, very good. You can even add Robert Pires into that when Arsenal were really at their peak. In terms of Australia, I mean, there are obviously some Socceroos. I had a very, very soft spot for Mark Viduka, not just because of his talent, but also for his personality of Jukes. He was totally unaffected by all the fame and all the noise that was around him. He didn't care at all. He was very, very down to earth, and I love that about Dukes. And in A-League terms, I loved watching Thomas Broich of Brisbane. He was, again, in A-League terms, two steps ahead of everybody else. He was just a terrific footballer, a nice guy as well.
Yeah, back on Mark Viduka, and I think his mystique about he's so recluse and you don't really hear from him. I could listen and read Mark Viduka content all day. I just find it so fascinating, and I think might have been before COVID, was it Dave Davidovic? Dave Davidovic might have went over to Croatia and caught up with him at his coffee shop and things like that. It's just
Michael Caine, actually, who did it.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
I saw him, yeah.
But, yeah, he's just so fascinating.
And then Nick.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'll give you one very quick story. So I don't know if you know this about Dukes, but He was famously lackadaisical about where he needed to be and things he needed to bring, you know, on tour or away with the Socceroos. So Josip Skoko was essentially his minder whenever he was with the Socceroos. He did everything for him.
A great Geelong man, Josip Skoko too.
Yeah. So this one time we were at the Asian Cup in 2007 and we were at the Socceroos team hotel in Hanoi. They were due to play Japan in the quarterfinals of the Asian Cup. And we were at the team hotel waiting for a press conference and to do interviews. And there was a lot of journalists, a lot of people milling around the lobby. And Mark Viduka sort of rocked up last, just in his flip-flops and a pair of shorts and a scruffy T-shirt. And he sort of ambled into the lobby, saw all these people, looked around, and then clocked me. And he went, oh, hello, mate. What are you doing here? And I said, I'm here for the press conference. Oh,
Is there a press conference today? No, there you go. I didn't know. I said, I think you're one of the players that are down to the interview, Dukes. He went, oh, okay. I'll have to ask your suit. He didn't know.
Oh, that's great. What a man. So we move on. We might move on to something a little bit more closer to home now with regards to Newcastle United. You've commentated the A-League and you've seen this guy's career. He got from when it started to kind of took off. Garang Kuol. So he's had, last season he was at Hearts and this season he's at Vallandome. I think it's fair to say none of them really worked as well as he would like or Newcastle would probably like as well. I think personally it's a big season for him next year. He's not just for his sort of Newcastle careers, but I think his career in general. What have you made of him and what do you think he should do next season?
Well, you know, with players like Garang, and he's not the first to go overseas at a young age. It was always my fear that going to a club the size of Newcastle could potentially be problematic for him. That's nothing against Newcastle United. He's probably not ready to start in their first team as yet, but there is a danger with young Australian players because they don't cost very much money, relatively speaking, that they get lost in the system. They really have to stand out, as all players from overseas do, to be able to, you know, earn a place in that first team squad. Now, clearly, they sent him out to Hearts, and this season to Volendam to, get some first team experience, which is good. But he's learning in the same way that a lot of Aussie kids have learned in the past, that playing in Europe is night and day in comparison to the A-League. And I'm not necessarily talking about the standard of play. I'm talking about the conditions of your job. And the fact is that, you know, in Europe, in fact, in most parts of the world, they live and breathe football. And the competition is huge for places. And you might be a big star here or big potential star, but when you go overseas, you're just another player. And you've got other things to deal with, you know, cold European winters, different sorts of food. In Garang's case in Holland, although they speak a lot of English, there'll be a different language to get to grips with as well. And
you might struggle to understand the Scottish language.
Yeah. And, you know, he's probably also got three or four kids who are the same age and probably similar talent levels who would kill their own grandmother to get a shirt in the first team. So, you know, he's got to deal with all that. Now, personally speaking, I think he'd have been better off staying another year in the A-League. You know, we saw this with his brother. Alu Kuol burst onto the scene with the Mariners. Everybody went, wow, what a talent. And he was, and still is. He went over to Stuttgart and disappeared. And 2 years later, he's back in the A-League starting again. So I understand why they go. And it's not necessarily that it's all a bad experience, because he'll be learning a lot whilst he's over there. But when you're not playing first team games, and I think he's only made a handful of appearances off the bench in 2024 for Volendam, you know, that can affect your confidence. It can change you as a player. And I think going abroad at, what was he, 17, 18, for me, it might have been a year too early, but, you know, he's still got plenty of time. He's a great talent. Hopefully, you know, he'll put all that he's learned into practice next season, because you're right in saying it's a massive season for him. Because if it doesn't happen for him next year, he'll be back in the A-League.
Yeah. Part of me wouldn't mind him staying back at Central Coast, maybe just to find his feet again. And I said on the podcast when he sort of signed, I didn't mind the Hearts thing for 6 months, purely because there was three Socceroos there already, and it might have been a little bit easier for him to acclimatise to the different country environment and all that, and probably being away from home for the first time, away from his family and everything like that. I could kind of understand, and I thought that made a lot of sense. And not necessarily, it wasn't more about games that sort of first 6 months, it was more about just get your feet on the ground and get yourself settled in. And hopefully this season was going to be a one where he could go away and in a lesser league, get some games, bit of confidence and things like that. But obviously it hasn't worked out. And yeah, I probably wouldn't mind him seeing coming back to the A-League just to kind of recalibrate himself, get his confidence back on, and then maybe go to another club in Europe, another loan club anyway, and hopefully get back to where he thinks he should be with his confidence up a little bit more.
Yeah, and you know, obviously we want him to succeed because he is a huge talent. But if I can, you know, put the focus on a similar sort of a player, you know, at the moment in the A-League, we're looking
at
who's about to go to Bayern Munich. Now, he's stayed that extra half season with Adelaide United. I hope that's going to be enough. But, you know, you're already seeing that he's struggling a little bit coping with some of the pressure he's under in Australia. Now, you know, when he goes to a club the size of Bayern Munich, that is going to be tenfold. So, you know, it's a big jump. Conditions in Australia are, you know, they're quite comfortable for players by and large. You know, the weather's nice. If you're a good player, you're almost, you know, guaranteed your place at least in the squad on match day. You don't have to deal with, you know, foreign language. You've got all your family, your friends around you. Going to Europe is tough for a lot of these players. You've got to be very strong mentally to succeed, as well as have the talent on the field. And you know, quite a few of them don't make it. There's countless examples in the past. Even Aaron Moy, you know, had to come back to the A-League to relaunch before he went back overseas.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even Tom Rokic did for a little bit as well. I remember he came back to Melbourne Victory for that short loan spell. I know he had Ubis. And he's kind of almost limited and stuff like that. But look, I think he's one of our greatest players in the last kind of 15 years as well.
Yeah, he has talented players. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. So it's just on the A-League. Like, what do you think the current status of the A-League is at the moment? And I don't want to get into the fans versus federals and things like that. That's another rabbit hole. But for the league in general, I think right. It doesn't get the... I wouldn't say the publicity. We know, very well documented the lack of publicity and things like that. But I honestly think it's one of the most entertaining leagues in the world, and people just don't give it the time of day.
There's nothing wrong with the football. There is a perception problem with the standard of football, and that's largely because most of the teams are relatively young, and people have already committed to overseas club. You know, we've spent 30 minutes here. You talk about you being a Newcastle fan, me being a Manchester City fan. So, you know, it's about getting that next generation of supporter to go through. So in future generations, like me and my dad and granddad, you know, that heirloom is passed down and they're a Sydney FC fan or they're a Melbourne Victory fan or Perth Glory or Adelaide, whatever. That takes time. In terms of the on-field standard, there's nothing wrong with it. But unfortunately, you can't talk about that in isolation without also speaking about the off-field stuff. And unfortunately, the game in this country still isn't run well enough. As you say, it would take a whole podcast to go into the individual issues, so I won't. But until the game is better administrated in this country, it will continue to struggle. And of course, you know, the media coverage is not good enough, but that's what you get when you have a country that is dominated almost entirely by one media operation being News Corp. And of course, they are no longer in football. So they're not going to write about it or give it publicity. And it's a big problem. But, you know, that's not something that the game can do much about. But on field, it's fine.
Yeah, I love it. Look, I watch as many games as I can because it's entertaining every week. Every game's got a talking point or something exciting happens in every game. So
sorry to interrupt. There's just one little point here that the Euro snobs, as we call them, you don't give the A-League the time of day. Oh, it's not as good as this league. It's not as good as that league. Well, you know, over the last two seasons, A-League clubs have sold almost 35 players to the top leagues in Europe. I'm not just talking about Premier League. Obviously, it's not Premier League at the moment, but the first divisions around Europe, 35 players over the last two seasons. So, you know, the league is doing something right because they're coming, taking our players and paying transfer fees for them. So,
yeah,
You know, that should underline that the league is of good.
Yeah, and I think that's as badly as it is, that should be viewed as a real positive, that we are capable with sort of limited resources and funding and everything like that. We are capable of producing good players and giving the opportunities to them to play in Europe and other high leagues and things like that. And so it's
money that comes in for those transfer fees is reinvested in the academies to produce the next generation, which, to be fair, the clubs are trying to do. You know, that's fine. We want players to go on to play in Europe because that obviously helps the national teams as well. But they start in the A-Leagues and, you know, maybe people should give it more of a chance. But there's a big perception problem in this country. I don't know why.
No, and Central Coast are arguably probably nearly the least wealthiest club in the league. And I think their model is absolutely perfect with the way they churn through young talent, sell them, reinvested in the academy, and the cycle just keeps going and going and going.
Absolutely. They're the benchmark, along with Adelaide.
Yeah.
The only problem with Adelaide at the moment is that they don't seem to have reinvested a lot of that money into their first team. Yeah. They're struggling, whereas the Mariners seem to be able to pull, you know, rabbits out of a hat. I mean, they lost half a team at the back end of last season and their manager.
And their manager, yeah.
And they're still top of the league. So, you know, it can be done. But you've got to be smart about it. And yeah, the Mariners are the benchmark at the moment in that regard. Yeah,
they are. We'll get back on to Man City. So before we get into the game, we've got this game and then the international break, then Arsenal at home. Is this instead of the relegation six-pointer, is this a title six-pointer, do you think?
Well, I'd prefer this. And I've been involved in plenty of the other.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, look, it's an important few weeks, but I don't think it'll be decisive. You know, there are other competitions as well that we're involved in. FA Cup, obviously, with this, with Newcastle, and, you know, Champions League too. But the game against Arsenal, you know, has a bearing, as the game against Liverpool did at the weekend. But, you know, 1 point between three clubs with 10 games to go makes for a great title race. And there'll be a couple of twists and turns. You know, not all three teams are going to win all of their remaining games. So it'll be a tight finish. I mean, obviously, I'm hoping that, you know, we do it, because if we do, it'll be four in a row and nobody's
first time ever. So yep,
that'll be a nice little bit of history for us. But yeah, you know, it's the Arsenal game is looming large, but we've got to take care of your mob first at the weekend.
That shouldn't be a problem. We'll get to that too early. So, coming off the treble, still involved in all three competitions this season, although not top at the moment, but up to their ears in it. How have you assessed the season so far as a fan?
It's been a bit up and down, to be honest. Relatively speaking, obviously, you know, we're still managing to win the majority of games. I don't think we've hit the same standards that we did last year yet. Now, there's been a couple of reasons for that. The departure of Ilkay Gundogan, I think, has had more of an impact than perhaps even Pep thought it would. He was a very, very important part of our team last season. Of course, he signed for Barcelona. And for a while, we looked a little bit directionless without him. The injury to Kevin De Bruyne, obviously, back in September, he was out for quite a lengthy stint, was an issue. Although Phil Foden has really matured, in my opinion, this season. And as a result, of course, Haaland has not scored as many because, you know, the telepathic understanding between Haaland and De Bruyne was one of the main reasons for the treble, or a big reason for the treble last season. So now that those two are back in tandem, albeit not quite firing on all cylinders just yet, I think it's a positive for us in the final third of the campaign. Phil Foden, for me, so far has been one of the players of the season. He's been absolutely terrific. But it's not been quite as good as last season. But, you know, we're splitting hairs. I mean, goodness me, how do you top a treble-winning season? How do you even equal a treble-winning season? You know, you're on top of Mount Everest and you're asking them to climb it again in even more spectacular fashion. So,
it's hard. You know, there are teams around us that are damn good, Liverpool and Arsenal being two of them. So you can't win every single game by 6 or 7 nil.
It's hard. Like, sometimes people don't understand that teams lose games, and it's okay to lose games. Like, and especially with our fan base, everyone seems to lose their mind when we lose a game. And it doesn't matter if it's to Manchester City or we drew with Bournemouth and Luton and things like that, Nottingham Forest at home on Boxing Day. People just lose their minds. And we've had an awful season in terms of injuries and things like that. I've never seen anything like my 38 years supporting the club. And I hope to never see anything like it again. And people just don't. Maybe it's a social media thing where it's just the instant reactions and hot takes where people try to get attention and things like that.
You know, I think you are now experiencing what we experienced a few years ago because of the huge investment by the Saudi owners. The expectation levels have now risen to unreasonable levels, and it takes time to build a team. I mean, people forget, you know, we were taken over by the Emirates in 2008. We didn't win a trophy for 3 years. It takes time to build, even to crack that top four on a regular basis, because those teams are so far ahead. Now, you know, this is partly, I mean, we're not going to get into all the financial aspects, but this is one reason why I rail so much against people's perceptions that financial fair play is a really good thing for the game. It's not. It's a really good thing for the teams at the top of the game, because it exacerbates the financial chasm between the haves and the have-nots. And it leaves the likes of Newcastle United prior to your Saudi takeover, Manchester City prior to the Emirati takeover, Chelsea prior to Roman Abramovich, and all the others miles and miles behind. You've got to be allowed to invest in your team. Now, you can hold views on whether investment from Saudi Arabia is a good thing morally, and you can bring human rights into it, and I would, you know, agree with you 100%. But that's for the authorities to decide. Once they are in place, which they are in Newcastle and they are in Manchester, if they've got the money, why shouldn't they spend it on their business? I don't know of any other industry where you buy a business and people say, how much money have you got in the bank? Oh, we've got 50 trillion. Well, you can only spend a fraction of that. And you go, hang on a minute. I've paid for this business. This is my business. Why can't I invest in my own business? So I think you're paying the price for, I've gone off tangent a bit, but I think you're paying the price for those increased expectations. But because of the financial stringent rules now, it's not as easy for Newcastle to break in, perhaps, as it was for us all those years ago.
Yeah, and even with now the sort of fair market value sponsorship deals and things like that as well. Like, yeah, exactly right. But that's just another hurdle that sort of clubs like Newcastle have to try and overcome it, to try and we're trying our best to catch up our commercial revenue to try to increase our spending capacity. But when there's these roadblocks in place that you can't actually spend that much and things like that.
The roadblocks are purposefully put in place by the clubs to keep things the way they are. Now, speaking as an individual, I think it's good. I'm not saying it's great that Saudi Arabia per se has taken over Newcastle. Well, I said the same thing about Manchester City, by the way, with the Emirates. But in terms of, you know, the competitive nature of the Premier League, I think it's terrific that there are more clubs that can compete. Why shouldn't they? Why should they be financially restricted so that the big red cartel clubs, as we call them, can keep it all to themselves? Yeah. You know, they set these rules in train years ago so they could, you know, divvy up the Premier League and the Champions League money between themselves and ring fence it for generations. Well, that's not right either. So, but you know, I recognize it's a very thorny topic, and one that football is going to grapple with some time to come, I think.
Yeah, until there's enough teams to stand up against these big clubs and be the new noisy neighbours, if you like, then I don't think anything's going to really change. But we'll get to the game now on the weekend. I was having a look through the squad, the Man City squad at the moment. It looks like Jack Grealish is the only player that's unavailable at the moment, which is awful for us. And with no midweek game and the international break after this fixture, couldn't come at a worse time. So how can Newcastle win the game, Simon? Obviously not on talent, but what have you seen?
I don't know about that. You know, the Newcastle got some talented players. I like Almiron. I like Joe Linton when he's fit.
Yeah.
I like Longstaff. I like Alex Isak. You know, you've got some very good, talented players there at Newcastle. I think consistency is one thing that's eluded you, obviously, so far this season. And, you know, allied to that is you've conceded too many goals. And that's problematic, particularly when you're playing away from home. If this game was at St. James's Park, I would be a lot more concerned. But because it's at the Etihad, you know, the familiar conditions, home crowd behind them. I know there'll be a lot of Geordies there, but there'll be City fans there as well. I think City will be more in their comfort zone. So, you know, maybe the fact that Liverpool set a bit of a template last week as to how to play City. If you sit back and try and absorb pressure, you'll get murdered because we're too good. So, you know, maybe the plan is to go out and try and press City and, you know, hassle them into mistakes, which Liverpool did, to be fair, last week. Have Newcastle got the players that can do that? You're probably a better judge of that than me, but I would suggest that has to be the game plan, because if you just sit in a defensive block, sooner or later, City will find a way because we're not.
Yeah, it actually reminded me of the 3-3 draw early last year at St. James's Park. That was honestly one of the best Premier League games I've seen probably last year, and I'm not saying that as a Newcastle fan. Just the way it was back and forth, and it was just both teams just going at each other, and it was a great, the old cliche, it's a great advertisement for the league to watch it. And I thought they would have got a lot of confidence out of that they can go with these teams, and then nearly the last five times they've played, and they've kind of gone back into their shell a little bit.
You know, they've still been, you look at the results the last four or five games, and I think aside of one match that we won 2-0, there's only been one goal in it. There's been a couple of draws, but, you know, we've won the majority, but it's not been like 4-5-0 in recent times. So that, yeah, they've been close games. Newcastle are a good side, but I think they're just that one or two players short of being a genuine threat to the top four at the moment. It's not necessarily an attack. I think there's plenty of goals in that team when they're all fit and firing. But defensively, they're still a little bit suspect. That's only my opinion. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part. For me, that's part of the midfield problem as well, with Joel Linton injured, Tonali suspended as well. And Tonali was kind of brought in to be that defensive midfielder to allow Bruno to kind of get a bit further forward and things like that. Joel Linton just roaming around the middle of the park like a prime Vieira kind of thing, just disrupting everything.
So he's coming to City next season, is that right?
Well, for 100 million, yeah. 100 million will come in early handed for financial fair play for us. But, yeah, I think the injury to Nick Pope as well, he's more of a sweeper keeper, and back four have kind of still played that high line, but Martin Dubravka seems a bit more hesitant to kind of come out of his 18-yard box, and it just leaves, like, if you watch the goals that we've conceded, there's so many times where there's just lost maybe one defender and a keeper, or the striker's through on goal, past the defenders and things like that.
You know, I mean, the other player who is going to be out for City at the weekend is Ederson.
Oh, of course, yes.
So Stefan Ortega will be between the posts. Now, this is a big chance for Stefan because he thinks he should be a number one. So maybe that's an opportunity for Newcastle to try and test him, you know, particularly set pieces. Because he's a good goalkeeper, but he's not obviously played on a regular basis. Mm. He's going to get a run of games now because of that injury.
Well, I think Dubravka was the same when he came in. His first couple of games, he was pretty rusty. And he's always been a really good shot stopper, but I think his decision-making just wasn't that quite sort of up to game speed. It took him maybe two or three games to get back up with the pace of it, things like that. So that'll be interesting. But for Newcastle, there's a big question mark on Anthony Gordon. He went off with a knee injury on the weekend. That still hasn't been officially diagnosed publicly by the club anyway. There's been rumours that it's an ACL, or he'll be right if he gets picked for England overnight in a couple of weeks. So that's a wait and see. Dan Burns also a wait and see. He went off with an injury. I'm not sure if it was his shoulder popped out again or something. So we'll see how that goes. Harvey Barnes has done a hamstring injury during the week. I think when he come on, not the last game of the game before. So just as there was a bit of light at the end of the injury tunnel, we've got three more people in the treatment room, which is shocking. So it's going to be interesting, I think. Yeah. And they're not just I think Liverpool had their own little injury crisis where Salah was away and done his hamstrings, even though he was away with Egypt. And their injury crisis was more of a soft tissue, like a calf, hamstring, groin, 3 or 4 weeks, whereas a lot of our players have been months and months. And we've been relying on the same kind of 13 players to play majority of the games this season, which is when you've thrown your Champions League with quarterfinals of the League Cup and quarterfinals now of the FA Cup as well. It's a lot of games for the same sort of players as well. And I'm very scared that the guys that have been relied upon are going to start sort of dropping off a little bit, and hopefully they don't, but they might be picking up injuries just because of the sheer volume of games they had to play, unfortunately, as well. And Elliot Anderson, he's back in fitness, so he might be an option on the wing now with Harvey Barnes. But I think with the Miggy Almiron, who you mentioned earlier, I think him and Jacob Murphy and Alexander Isak are going to be the front three for the next probably two or three games as well. Kieran Trippier is still injured too. So Lewis Miley might start in the midfielding. He's been a revelation this year as a 17-year-old, and he seems to be a very quiet guy, but he's really acquitted himself well to the pace and the physicality of the Premier League. And I've heard a few coaches sort of talk that I think the physicality is the biggest part. A lot of the players are technical enough, but it's just that physicality that they struggle with. But Miley's really sort of come in his own and handled that really well. So with Bird possibly injured, I'm not sure if we'll see Lewis Hall. I doubt it, but maybe Tino Livramento, who's been fantastic the games he's played and started for us as well. He might move to left back with Emil Kraft at right back as well. So there's a lot of question marks on our lineup, so I don't think anyone's really going to be sure what that 11 will look like until an hour before kickoff.
Yeah, well, you've just given me a lot of hope. I didn't realise it was that extensive, your age.
Yeah, no, Chelsea, yeah. I'm an optimistic reporter, but yeah. When the facts are the facts, if you know your team, you know who's available and who's not, it does kind of paint a pretty bleak picture. But as we've seen last round against Blackburn in the FA Cup, we should have steamrolled them on paper. I think they're languishing in the bottom third of the championship, hovering above relegation, and they gave as good as they got. It was a classic FA Cup tie, and unfortunately for them, they got bundled out on penalties, but anything can happen in a cup game, so we'll see what happens. Before I let you go, mate, a prediction. How do you think this game's going to end?
Well, look, obviously I think City will win. I don't think it'll be a cakewalk, but maybe 1-0 or 2-1.
That's fantastic. I think it's going to be a blowout. I'll give you 3 or 4 the way we're defending and the players we've got available. So luckily it's 4 a.m. You might get a little bit more of a kip and go back to sleep for a couple of hours and sleep it off, and just hope it was a really bad dream. So that might wrap us up, Simon. I can't thank you enough tonight for jumping on you. We're a very busy man, and on an hour for us tonight's been absolutely tremendous. So thank you very much for joining us.
Yes. No problem. Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
No worries. And we'll be back probably Sunday night for a review, so stick around and stay tuned for that. But Simon, once again, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much, and we'll see you all next time.